was the thief that she would love him? A youth, just a boy with hardly a beard and no sense at all, she told herself. A liar, she thought. An enemy, a threat. He was brave, a voice inside her said. He was loyal. Not loyal to me, she answered. Not brave on my behalf. Brave and loyal, the voice repeated. A fool, she answered back. A fool and a dead one. She ached with emptiness.
Me too! Don't worry, kids. Jen's not dead.
Yet.
I'm Noelle.
And I'm Caitlin.
And this is the Aetolian Archives, your Queen's Thief reread podcast to get you through the wait for Return of the Thief. It's August 11th, 2019.
And we just found out that there is now a release date for Return of the Thief. It's
Woo-hoo!
August 25th, 2020, which I'm just realizing we should have started a countdown to let you know how many days that is, but what's...
It's roughly a year.
Yes. A year plus 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Is it 15 days or is it 14 days? Who, whatever.
This is a no arithmetic zone.
I can't count. We continue our discussion of the Queen of Aetolia with chapter 19. It's a pretty long one with a lot of emotional action.
It features two queens finally talking, a dying emperor's succession drama, a death scare, a sleeping boy, sexual tension, and the Olympics of passive aggression.
Big mood. So there's quite a lot of Edis and Aetolia together in this chapter for the first time in the series, right?
Yeah, there have been some... Aetolia has remembered when they have met in the past, but we haven't actually seen them together in the present.
Yeah.
Before this moment.
Edis is trying to figure Aetolia out in the scene that we see of them. Edis was not so much reserving her judgment as trying to unmake it.
I love that line.
Yeah. She thought she knew the Queen of Aetolia and wondered what Eugenides could have seen in her. She knows now Eugenides is gonna marry her.
Mm-hmm. And there's that big theme. You, the reader, also have to constantly unmake your judgments.
Mm-hmm.
And we see, of course, more of the contrast between them, which is in high relief now that they're standing right next to each other. Mm-hmm. Aetolia is in these voluminous skirts, and she's helped out of the boat, while Edis is standing there wearing no crown in a tunic identical to that which her soldiers are wearing, just embroidered in gold.
Mm-hmm.
And Aetolia is very conscious of that difference.
Yeah.
Of course, that femininity is part of how Aetolia asserts her power.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, is that I guess we can't really say for certain how she feels on the inside about her gender,
mm-hmm.
but she definitely uses it to her own advantage. She uses it as a weapon in manipulating other people's views of her. She definitely uses Nahuzurush's assumptions about her gender against him.
Mm-hmm. There's that moment where she's helped out of the boat, and she has two spots of color in her cheeks, I think the narration mm-hmm. said. And we had a discussion on the Tumblr, which we will link to in the description, about why is she blushing in that moment? Is it just from activity, or is it from embarrassment of being helped out of the boat in front of Edis? But it seems to me like that kind of action is a visible assertion of her power, because she is so powerful that she does not need to do things for herself. She does not need to be able to defend herself. Even though, of course, she can defend herself, she's carrying knives, but she gives the appearance of, I am untouchable.
Yeah, that's a really interesting interpretation of that scene that I hadn't thought of before. And, so last episode, I know we had some confusion over whether, Edis really had gotten Aetolia's full message that she was going to marry Jen, because at the beginning of that chapter, Edis's narration said, like, to leave, like, to not attack would be to leave Eugenides to whatever mercy Aetolia and the Medes would show,
mm-hmm.
which she didn't think would exist. Now, some light is shed on that, because a paragraph here starts out with, "You will marry him?" Edis asked, hesitant again. "I said I would," snapped Aetolia. So, Edis knows about it.
But she is hesitant to believe it.
Yeah. So I guess we don't know, did she get that information just through the clandestine message, which is all we've seen, or was there more conversation off the page where they said it more explicitly? Like, I don't think we can really take that for granted either.
And she has talked about it with the Minister of War, although the Minister of War didn't mention his head injury to her. Because she's surprised to hear about it. And there's that great exchange where Atolia says he had to be forcibly stopped from strangling his son. And Edith says, oh, well, yeah, haven't we all? And that makes Atolia smile.
And in that expression, Edith saw some hope for her thief and her heart lightened. They're definitely both seeing each other as allies now. Mm-hmm. And like Atolia refers to them as a...
us.
As an us, yeah. It was... talking about them versus the Medes, and Edith took note of the comfortable presence of us in the Queen's analysis.
And that's, in terms of what we have been able to see, that's a pretty quick turnaround.
Yeah.
They were just at war.
Right.
And I don't know if that's Atolia adapting quickly to changing circumstances, or if this is something that she has thought about. Because she never wanted the Medes.
Yep.
In her country.
Yeah.
And she must know that there has to be a united front.
Mm-hmm.
And so has she also been thinking about how to come to this eventuality?
Yeah. Well, she's at least had a few days of knowing that's how this is going to end up. But, I mean, we can't know, you know, even before this marriage debacle, kidnapping scenes, what's her mind on that path anyway, because she was still at war with the two other peninsular countries.
But she was never really planning to make a treaty with the Medes. So what was her plan?
She must have known, like, the options for getting the Medes out are very limited.
And Edith does say we could make a treaty without a marriage. So it's not entirely dependent on Jen. Jen just created the circumstances that allowed them to ally. So would it have happened? But it wouldn't. I don't think it would have happened anyway.
I mean, like, Atolia never would have met with either Edith or Jen without being actually kidnapped.
And there remains tension.
Right.
Which we'll see in the next chapter.
Oof. So much.
So much.
So much.
If anything, it's only gotten more complicated.
Yeah.
Politically and interpersonally.
And something else in the scene I wanted to bring up, because it's just about her, Megan's writing style, is on 308 in this edition, which is the Vince Natale cover edition. It's just about the way Megan uses paragraph breaks, which I think we've talked about this before, is that, so we have the scene with Edith and Atolia where it ends with they both smile like polecats.
The two queens sat for a moment in happy agreement.
And then there's a paragraph break, and it says, Edith looked around as if recalling a question that had nagged at her for several hours. Where's Eugenides? She asked. For a moment, the Aetolian queen was immobile, her smile gone as if it had never been, and then a few sentences later, the smile faded from Edith's face. So, what I wanted to say about this is, in past scenes where Megan has used paragraph breaks in this same way, sometimes time has passed in that paragraph break, and that's why it's there. But sometimes it hasn't, as in this scene, because they're still smiling.
The transition between the two queens sat for a moment in happy agreement and Edith looked around as if recalling a question.
Yes. So,
yeah, you're right.
No time has passed because they're still smiling. So I'm just thinking, is it to indicate the shift in tone? Indicate something new is coming up?
Yes. And
yeah.
I think the implication is that they did sit for a moment. You know, there was a beat.
A pause.
There. Yeah, they have not mentioned Eugenides before that moment.
Right. It pays to see how she uses these breaks and when. Because sometimes they're hiding deeper things.
Yeah. I think maybe what we can glean from that in terms of what Edith is thinking is that they have been dancing around the topic of Jen for this entire conversation.
Oh, yeah.
And she's been waiting to bring that up. And now we've reached this moment where we're almost on the same page. We're feeling kind of comfortable. So now...
make jokes.
Let's stop. Here we go. I have to talk to you about this boy. Where's my boy?
Atolia says she forgot that she had Jen locked up separately, which cannot be the truth. Why would she not have released him with the other prisoners? And I was thinking she probably wanted to see him in person again before.
Yeah, she doesn't want him to slip away.
Yeah.
As soon as she has him, she's worried about losing him.
Yep.
Which we see when she comes into the room and she thinks that he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
Like, without even checking, she just sees that he's lying there and assumes that, all right, okay, he's dead, it's over. Goodbye, everyone.
With the wine cup tipped over.
No more books. Broken.
Just goes right to the worst case.
Yeah.
Scenario.
Because that's how she thinks. And it's a sudden attack of sentimentality, right?
Yeah, which we've never gotten even, like, an inkling of from her before.
Yeah. All of a sudden, when she thinks about the fact that, oh, this may not happen after all, she feels like, oh, I could have loved him.
Or she feels that she does.
Yeah.
Is that it says, how cruel of the gods, she thought, to send her a boy she would love without realizing it. How appropriate that the bridegroom she would have chosen to marry be poisoned. So that's when she realizes that she has been in love with him for some time, I think.
Yeah, and she thinks that him dying is justice against her.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to people who've read this book and who have felt that it gets cheesy in that moment.
Really?
I'm interested in that tension between the very sentimental and the very pragmatic, which is all through this book,
mm-hmm.
and why they seem to get more and more extreme. She has a moment standing there alone, and Edis moves by her and does not touch her. And I thought that was a really sad and beautiful little image.
Yeah, it says, like, without even touching or brushing by the flowing sleeve of her robe.
Yeah. And she has this tense internal moment where she's allowing herself to feel all of those sentimental things.
Yeah. Which is such a big deal because this is something she doesn't let herself feel anything.
Yeah. And she says he's a youth, just a boy with hardly a beard and no sense at all. And it's so refreshing to see a relationship with an age gap in a fantasy novel intended for young people where the woman is older.
Yes.
Very, very specific.
It's a breath of fresh air.
I love Tamara Pierce. I have her autograph. But boy, does she love the young women with
she
the older
does.
Men. And she's aware of that pattern, and she stopped doing it so much in her more recent work.
In industry, even just a bigger cultural thing.
Yeah, and so Megan Wayland Turner gives us this swapped relationship, which, you know, I mean, is not even common in any media.
Mm-hmm.
Jen becomes the one who is innocent, who is feisty, who is making her believe in love again.
The one who's what are the words for this? Like, you know that romance trope where, like, the emotional older man, the emotionless older man, like, who's forgotten fun.
Yeah.
Like, suddenly falls in love with someone dynamic and energetic who just lets loose and makes them realize, like...
Is Eugenides a manic pixie dream boy?
Yes.
Caitlin. We've cracked it!
To Irene's, what did you call her last episode? Depressed goblin woman.
Depressed goblin nightmare woman?
Yes.
Edis is mistaken for a man by the Aetolian guard.
Yeah.
That's a brief but very interesting moment.
Yes.
Because they don't know her. They're not used to her.
Mm-hmm.
But she gives them a look that could melt lead. And he realizes his mistake very fast.
I like that interaction because we see so much throughout the rest of the novel of Helen being... You know, she's kind, she's, like, she compromises, she values people, but this is showing, you know, when she needs to, she can be someone who has looks that would melt lead.
God, Helen's such a soft butch. This book switches point of view more than any other book in the series, and in this chapter we get Atolia, Edis, and Jen point of view in one chapter. And it almost feels like all the points of view that we have seen over the course of the book are now converging.
Yeah.
Because the people are actually communicating, or trying to communicate with each other truthfully now.
Yeah. And they're all, this is the chapter where their goals intertwine, where they all have the same goals now. So in the scene where Atolia thinks Eugenides is dead, and then he wakes up and the three of them talk, he and Atolia both have moments of intense vulnerability, with Atolia seeing him asleep and then seeing him, you know, realize, like, he thinks his hand is still there and then realizes it's not. And then
he thinks he's in the king's prison in Sunnis at first when he wakes up, which is one of the first instances we see. Because, I mean, there's a lot about his trauma in this book, but specifically about his hand. Mm-hmm. And we don't really think about the trauma that he already had.
Yeah, I mean, he went through a lot. He killed someone. He had to deal with all of the baggage that goes with your first time murder.
Your baby's first murder.
And then Atolia's vulnerability in this scene is Eugenides looked up at her and Atolia felt transparent, as if her mask were gone, as if he could see her heart and know that a moment before it had been stopped by grief. This is a moment where they're now seeing past all of the deceptions that they've created to keep themselves safe.
Then they immediately get passive aggressive. Like, they have this moment of intense, perfect understanding. And then Jen says, he says, a girl brought me dinner. She was very pretty. After a pause, he added, and very kind. Like, you asshole. Both of them, they're aware of how vulnerable this moment is. They go on the defensive and they retreat back into, each of them has this performance. Mm-hmm. I think when I'm king, she can be my first mistress. He's really pushing her.
Yeah. And she says, you have any mistresses and I'll cut your other hand off.
Which makes Edis ready to explode. But Jen laughs. And he grins at her, which is his first grin of the book.
Yeah. After Edis made such a big deal about losing it.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's back, guys.
Because he's trying to... He's trying to push her
into reacting. He wants proof that she cares.
Yeah. He now and ongoing likes when she's possessive of him.
Yeah.
Because that's how she expresses her attachment. That's her love language. That's healthy.
And then Edis is still in the room when they're having that intense earring moment you pointed out in our notes.
You can picture her being like, guys, can I get a waffle? Can I please get a waffle?
The last scene in this chapter is Jen saying, oh, I didn't think about being king. Like, I knew I had to do it, but I didn't think about it. Like, oh my goodness.
Oh no.
Oh no.
All those obligations, the clothes, everyone looking at me all the time.
Ugh.
Oh.
I feel so bad for him.
What a dumbass, though.
What a dumbass, though. Is Atolia going to marry you and move into my library?
That's chapter 19. Next week, politics is hard and love is even harder. Oh, and Kamet sets stuff on fire.
Oh, and we also got a comment on the Tumblr from Veyati saying, just wanted to throw it out here that I've made a Queen's Thief / Eugenides subreddit because there wasn't one and I thought there probably should be. It's r/ Queen's Thief. Thank you. That is great.
Yeah, we'll check it out and everybody should check it out too. That's just Queen's Thief. Don't try and put the apostrophe in there.
Send us your comments, questions, thoughts. Chime in at atolianarchives.tumblr.com.
Be blessed in your endeavors.
listening. This has been an Amateur Embroidery production. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, anywhere podcasts are available.
That's healthy.